Hey everybody, just a quick reminder about the upcoming Mormon Expression live event at 7 p.m. on Friday, November 18th, 2011. We'll be recording Mormon Fight Songs for Dummies and Sing-Along at the University of Utah Post Theater in Salt Lake City. For more details, please visit our website, mormonexpression.com, and look for the Live Lectures tab. Hope to see you there.
My heart has no words. No tears left. Mind had done gone crazy. Went off and married my fears. Now I'm standing here with nothing left to tell you. I'm standing here with nothing to prove.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Mormon Expression Voices. This is Heather, and today I'm going to be having a conversation with Glenn Osland of the Mormon Expression podcast. Hello, Glenn.
Hey, Heather. How you doing?
I'm doing well. How about yourself?
Doing pretty good.
So why don't you tell me what we're going to be talking about today?
Well, we're going to be talking about me.
That's right. Everybody's favorite subject, right? Themselves.
Themselves, yeah. Oh, I thought you meant just me.
Well, you too.
Well, okay.
Okay, so today we're going to be talking about your life and journey through Mormonism. And I think to kick that off, we ought to start at the very, very, very beginning. A very good place to start.
Well, I don't remember the very beginning because I went through this veil of forgetfulness, see?
Well, then... How about we start at your childhood?
Okay.
Where the veil of forgetfulness kind of
kind of lifts away.
Yes.
Well, okay. I'm the oldest in my family, and
how many kids?
Three. Mm-hmm. Three surviving. You know, there. I have a younger brother who died. He was 2 weeks old. 2 years younger than I was. He died at 2 weeks, and, you know, my mom brought him home from the hospital and didn't realize he had a defect in his heart. Kind of a tragic story. It was a, you know, big impact on them.
Yeah.
My parents, obviously, as it would be. And I remember, you know, being a kid, having something like this happen to me. I didn't really understand death at 2 years old, but I understood mm-hmm. that if I knelt down and I prayed to Heavenly Father, he'd send another brother to me. You know, that's what my mom told me to do. So I knelt down and prayed, and you know, there's this family story that I got up after saying amen, and I walked into the room where my brother Mark had been, and my mom said, you know, where are you going? I said, oh, I'm going to get the baby, you know, because that's how faithful I was, right?
At 2 years old
or 3 or 4, however old it, you know, I was. But my brother Jeff was born when I was 5. So there's a 5-year difference between us. And then my sister Melissa, who's been on the podcast a few times, mm-hmm. She's 10 years younger than I am. So that's the three of us. And Mormon upbringing, you know, roots going all the way back to, Artemis Millett, who designed the Kirtland Temple, is an ancestor. Philemon C. Merrill, who was a bodyguard of Joseph Smith, maybe a Danite, I don't know, or a Danite, I would pronounce it, in Nauvoo days. So.
And what was your personal family like? Were you guys a liberal Mormon family, or were you rather conservative?
Yeah, we were pretty conservative. You know, my dad was one of these guys who really loved looking at Bruce R. McConkie, Hugh Nibley. He always had like Nibley books that mm-hmm. he was reading, and he would get really excited about Nibley, and he would pull me into his study. And, you know, this is, you know, I was probably, a teenager by this time, or at least, you know, 10, 11, maybe at the youngest, when I could understand some things. But, you know, so he would pass along a lot of this excitement to me. And I remember one of the first things that he talked about was, this group of angels called the Watchers. And I don't remember what Nibley book he found this in, but there were these Watchers that, if you read the Pseudepigrapha Book of Enoch, I think is where you find about the Watchers who were this group of angels that were charged to watch over the four corners of the earth, but they lusted after the daughters of men, and so they fell. And they brought all of their knowledge of the universe and passed it along to men. So kind of like the Prometheus myth in Greek mythology. And what Nibley was doing with this, he was trying to draw parallels between the Greek mythology of, you know, Zeus, Apollo, etc., and to say maybe these guys were the personification of these actual watchers that we find in ancient scripture that haven't been canonized, instead of just saying, you know, look at two different mythological traditions in the world. You know, so my dad would get into those kinds of things, and it was an environment that was, you know, like there's so much more to the gospel. Mm-hmm. If you just look for it, it's right under our nose. I remember another one that he talked about, he got me really excited about when I was maybe 14 or 15 years old, was I think it's called the 13 planet theory. And there's, oh boy, I should have referenced this ahead of time. I don't remember where it is, but some section in the Doctrine and Covenants where there's a parable of Jesus going to these 12 different vineyards or something. And the last one, I don't know, he's killed or something. I don't remember exactly what it was, but, the way that he connected this with another book, with another thing, was that there were 13 planets and the earth was the most wicked of the 13.
All
of the other 12 know about each other. Mm-hmm. But we're the most wicked. I think it's Battlestar Galactica theology or something like that. You know, I mean, so that was the kind of house that I grew up in. It wasn't liberal where we had Dialogue and Sunstone magazines lying around. But it was, you know, my dad was really interested in the ancient mysteries. And so I grew up with this healthy respect and curiosity for the supernatural mysteries of the gospel.
Huh. Do you think that is where you also got your interest in folklore?
Well, I'm sure the seeds were planted very, very early, but the...
Or it's genetic.
My interest in folklore... probably grew out of that, definitely. But it was realized much later when stories that I heard on my mission and then started hearing other friends of mine reporting on things from their mission and going, oh, wait a second, that story happened in my mission. And I go, no, it happened in my mission. Then when I got to BYU and I was studying with a professor there, Bert Wilson, got a chance to work in its folklore archives, and I worked with him for a couple of years there. That's how I got interested in folklore. But I think you're right. You know, tying that to my upbringing, early years with my dad, certainly created some fertile ground there.
Right. So it was a faithful home. Didn't shy away from discussing the supernatural and that kind of thing. What was your experience as a child with the church? Were you a happy with the church kid? Go along with it. What are your earliest memories of your experiences with the church for yourself?
One of my earliest memories, man, I remember standing up to bear my testimony. I must have been like 5 years old or something, and I remember being so confused because I'd never stood up on the stand before and looked out. And looking out to the cultural hall and seeing the stage on the far end of the cultural hall and thinking that it was another stand, you know. So I thought there were like concurrent meetings going at the front and the back. And as soon as I spoke into the microphone and I could hear the echo, I thought there was another kid on the other end of the building that was speaking too. So I stopped because I didn't want to interrupt what he was saying. Isn't it? Yeah. And
so you were like an animal that gets in front of a mirror and thinks there's another.
Right. Animal. Yeah. It was kind of like that. Yeah. Yeah. So, but I mean, the church was, you know, I mean, Pinewood Derbies, and I participated in road shows, and, you know, church sports and stake dances. And there was a program called Teen Elect where I grew up. You know, I grew up in Arizona. Teen Elect was where they taught us manners, you know, like what fork to use for a salad and which hand to use, you know, for this or that. And then dancing.
Ballroom we learned about dancing.
And, oh, it was like the four step or something, box step. I don't remember what it was, but
so ballroom dancing is not as big in the Mormon Arizonans as it is in the Mormon Utahns.
I don't remember learning ballroom dancing. I just it was more like just regular dance. I mean, the kind of dancing that we would then do at stake dances.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. And you know, there was this thing when I was 12 years old. There was a big conference for all of the girls in the young women's program called Daughters of Zion. They had it up in Flagstaff. My mom was very musical and her family's very musical. And so she would always, and this is another early memory of mine from church, is I was always singing in church, and I would always find out that I was singing in church like the day before or maybe the morning of. Mm-hmm. And it really annoyed me. But so I got signed up somehow to be a performer at this Daughters of Zion thing. And I remember going to the recording studio and recording songs with a group and learning dance steps. And when we went out, we performed at the in the stadium at NAU, I think is what it is, the university in Flagstaff, Northern Arizona University. And I was working concessions, and it was the first time I really had to deal with money. And they gave me an apron, and you know, like $1 bills were in one pocket and $5 bills were in another pocket and $10 bills, $20 bills. And that was it. You know, I didn't have a cash register. You know, girls would just come up and they would give me the money for whatever it was they wanted to buy. And I would make change and, you know, put things in my apron. And every once in a while, one of the bills would find its way into my back pocket. And,
Glenn.
Yeah, I know. I was a bad little kid, I guess. And I got back to the hotel room that night and went into the bathroom and locked the door and pulled out the money to see how much I had. And it was like $200. Yeah, I felt really guilty and thought, oh, man, what am I going to do about this? And I didn't tell anybody.
Did you spend it with regret?
This is my confession. Oh, I blew it on video games. Yeah, the 7-Eleven down the street from my house was the lucky. I don't think I ever paid tithing on it either.
Well, you're not supposed to pay tithing on ill-gotten gains, are you?
No, probably not. But, you know, I mean, that was kind of a thing. Not too long after that, I was at my grandparents' house, and I saw a couple of $5 bills in my uncle's room. He was just a few years older than me, and I took them. And that night, we got a call at the house, and he asked me point blank if I had taken them, and I lied. And he said, you know, Glenn, don't lie. I know you took them. That was my tithing money. Oh, and the guilt just flooded over me, and I started crying, and I said, I'm so sorry, man. I'm so sorry. And he was very kind and loving and taught me all about the principles of forgiveness and repentance. And so I learned it, you know, 12 years old or so, I was able to repent of that and overcome my nasty habit of thieving.
You were cured of your kleptomania.
Yeah, I was cured of it.
Well, that's good.
I haven't thieved a cent.
So, what about your teenage years?
You should call this Mormon Expression Confessions.
Yeah.
Instead of Voices.
Maybe we should.
Maybe we should call it Confessions.
Yeah. Or we'll probably have to edit this out, but do you know what would be a really cool feature is if we use that phone number that John has for people to call in their anonymous confessions.
Yeah.
And we like play them. I wonder what kind of weird things we'd hear about. I'm going to have to. Good idea. Okay. I'm going to have to run that by John and see what he thinks.
Yeah.
see if we can get that as like a major feature and play him at the end of every episode or something. Okay. All right. So how about your experiences as a teenager then with the church? Were you a rebellious teenager who came back to the church as an adult or?
No, I mean, see, you know, like I was actually a pretty good kid and I took the message of the gospel very seriously. And, you know, like the book of Abraham, the facsimiles that are in there with the Egyptian hieroglyphs and the footnotes that Joseph Smith has in there that tells you what each little piece means. And I'm giving air quotes, you know, that there's the ones in there that say ought not be revealed to the world at this time. And that was just absolutely fantastic to me. I thought, oh, you know, when I get the priesthood, when I'm 12 and I have the ministry of angels, maybe I might be able to someday be worthy enough to have this revealed to me. So, you know, I still had these kinds of thoughts, even though, you know, I wasn't perfect. But, you know, I took it very seriously. And maybe I should also back up just to when I was 5 years old and my dad, for an object lesson, wanted to teach me obedience. And so he drove me out into the middle of the desert and I got out of the car and he put a blindfold on me and he walked me out to the middle of a cactus patch. And he said, no. To get back to the car, you've got to follow the sound of my voice and just trust in me. And, you know, think of this as I am the Lord and I'm, you know, you're just listening to my voice and, you know, you've got to use your faith and I'll lead you safely through all of the trials of life or whatever it was that the cactus mm-hmm. has represented. Mm-hmm. And, I ended up stepping on a cactus that he didn't see. Well, I was actually wearing shoes without socks. I remember that very vividly. And it was one of these, I think they're called choya, the jumping cactus that, just jumped out and got me right above the shoe where my ankle was. And he didn't see it, you know, so he,
didn't quite have the effect he was hoping for.
No, it taught me a very different lesson than what he was hoping for, but, you know.
Is that a sore subject for him since?
I tease him about it, you know, and he takes it well enough, but he still stands by it as a pretty novel approach.
Okay.
He's waiting someday for a general authority to say it over the pulpit in general conference, you know, or... You know, I don't know.
Okay. So, you were a believing teenager. If I remember correctly, you felt like you were born into you, or that you had all of this awesome stuff that was headed your way and you felt you needed to live up to it. Correct?
Well, yeah. And a lot of that came from my patriarchal blessing. Obviously, you know, we get our patriarchal blessings when we're teenagers. Mine was when I was 18 and,
why'd you wait so long?
Well, part of it, I kind of used my patriarchal blessing interview as an excuse to talk to the bishop about masturbation because I didn't know how to broach the subject with him. And I was a late bloomer when it came to masturbation. I didn't know about that. I didn't know what it was until I was like 16. And so I just kind of stumbled across it. And then I started feeling guilty and went to the bishop. And you know, my bishop was actually really cool about it because he's you know, I went in to have this interview for the patriarchal blessing and he said, you know, well, I think you should get the blessing, you know, I've got this problem and he's like, well, I just think you should get it anyway. And so I put this, and I think I talked about this on the Peterson podcast, but, you know, I put myself under a self-imposed exile. And I just, like, I wanted to make sure that when I got the patriarchal blessing, that the promises from God came into a completely pure vessel. I didn't want any impurities blocking out all of that awesome stuff that I knew was going to be coming.
Because it's all based upon your righteousness.
Well, sure. I didn't want anything blocking the frequency.
Right, right.
And so I wanted to make sure I was pure. And, you know, this was also, you know, then I'm starting to date. And, you know, so then I had to go and talk to the bishop about a few things then. And I went through a repentance process where I don't remember what it was called. I don't think it's disfellowshipment when I was 18, but I couldn't take the sacrament for a few months.
For self abuse or for stuff you'd done on dates?
Yeah, I mean, it was like really innocent stuff on dates, you know, by anyone else's standards,
like,
you know,
over the sweater stuff.
Well, we don't need to get graphic, but.
Okay, anyway, so your patriarchal blessing.
I think this is important because my grandfather was in a rest home and we had to take him the sacrament. And so it was just my dad and I that would do the sacrament, and then my brother and sister and my mom were in there. And so I had the bishop tell me that I couldn't do this anymore, and it was super embarrassing.
Right.
To have to go in there and be like, oh, yeah, you know, this thing that I used to do, I can't do it anymore.
Right.
But their response to it was all, it was very, you know, reassuring. It's like, well, son, you know, we don't know what awful thing you've done, but we're glad you're taking the steps to make yourself right, you know, with the Lord. And, you know, I mean, I bought into it and I was glad I was making myself right. Because I wanted to get this patriarchal blessing, and so I did. You know, I was 18 when I got it, and it told me things like I would work with the lost tribes of Israel. I mean, it didn't say the lost tribes of Israel. It said get to know your brethren of the other tribes. In due time, you will come to know them and to work with their culture. And you know, I've spent 5.5 years of my life in Japan, so
yeah. So but,
you know, hey.
Validation of the blessing right there, right?
Yeah, you never know. Right. My mission president said that the Japanese were the lost tribes of Israel. There's a lot of people who believe that.
Just the Japanese or Asians?
Well, he said the Japanese. You know, I mean, we didn't get into that discussion about whether there were others. Okay. In the Asian culture who were, but you know, he would point to very specific customs that the Japanese have, you know, like a mikoshi, which is a portable shrine that they carry out for festivals. And you would say, you know, you look at the function of that shrine and the design of that shrine, and no other group of people in the world do anything like this except for the ancient Jews, as it's written in the Old Testament, the with portable, the Ark of the Covenant.
Mm-hmm, like the portable temple Ark of the Covenant.
Yeah, it's the portable temple. And I mean, that's sort of what the Mikoshi is, sort of. And people dance in front of it like it's described in the Old Testament, you know, like David did. And, you know, so there's all kinds of things like that Mikoshi that feed into this these stories about the Japanese and the lost tribes of Israel. It's fascinating. It's what I wrote my master's thesis on when I did my master's in folklore. So, you know, my patriarchal blessing told me things that, you know, I would have experiences that were great and marvelous that would cause tears to come to my eyes, and that, you know, the conditions of the world were such that the Lord needed strong warriors, and the division between the righteous and the wicked would become more prominent, and that I would be the leader of organizations within the church and president of quorums, and just things that really spoke to me and kind of made me feel important, like I wanted to, you know, that
you had
pretty much. I mean, I have this theory that a lot of the success of the church is providing very real meaning to people in their lives, because it puts you at the center of the universe. I mean, mm-hmm. It puts you at the center of God's plan. You are a child of God, and you know, there's a plan, you know, the great I'm trying to think, this is my work and my glory to bring to pass the immortality and eternal life of blank, you know, put your name here.
Right.
And you know, there's all these things that, that you can look at and plug yourself into, like a patriarchal blessing that puts you right at the center of this plan of restoration. And I was right there with it, all. So,
well, not only that, but the church teaches that that's where your self-worth should come from. I have female friends who write blogs about how you should feel beautiful because you're a daughter of God, you know, like it's, I see what, I agree with you that making people feel like they're special and important to the Creator, and that it has like a, like your eternal, you know, you have eternal importance can, you know, make somebody want to stick around and be a part of that. But okay. So,
well, that, that, and that's one of the things, you know, that, that seeing the recent Book of Mormon musical that I loved about Elder Price, that I think they got so right about that guy, was the, that, you know, but mostly me, you know, just that I'm going to do something incredible. And the way that the church talks about all of these incredible things, and then that you're going to be the person that does the incredible things, and how easily people can confuse doing something incredible with being someone incredible. Mm-hmm. And that, that was me, a lot. You know, so I was sucked into that, a lot as a kid and early up through my mission.
Okay. So before we talk about your mission, tell me about your first experience with the temple. Where, what, did it freak you out? Did it excite you?
No, I was excited for the temple. You know, I went through just after the changes to the ceremony had been made, so I never saw any of the punishments. Mm-hmm. You know, We talked about this earlier, and you asked how prepared I had been. I don't know that I was very well prepared, because I always had this fear in the back of my mind that when I went to the temple, there would be some kind of naked presentation in front of all of my ward members, you know, and I don't know where that came from. It was just, you know, maybe like those dreams that you have where you're at school and you're naked. I don't know, but it was always just this irrational fear. And so as soon as I went in and they said, okay, now it's time for the washing and anointings. And I did have to get naked for that. I kind of went, whoa, okay, right. What is going on here? but I felt actually very comfortable with that process. I felt like it was very discreet, and when I went through the temple, and especially when I put on the garment, I found it very comforting, because well, for one thing, it felt like a second baptism to me, and I felt like my previous indiscretions had all been wiped clean, and that I could start fresh. And I was always wanting to start fresh, you know, like I kind of joked about the patriarchal blessing, you know, not wanting to have any fuzz blocking the transmissions to heaven, you know, like I took that stuff pretty seriously. So feeling like this endowment had made me more pure and more clean, I felt like I would have a stronger connection to heaven, or a stronger connection to God. And so I liked that about it. And I also, because I always liked the, you know, had this curiosity for the supernatural mysteries of the gospel, I found the ritual of the endowment and all of the symbolism there very intriguing. And you know, the same types of curiosity that makes me a fan of the TV show Lost, you know, where trying to find meaning in everything, I would find in the temple ceremony. And especially because you grow up hearing people say things like, I learn something new every time I go. Mm-hmm. So I'm like, ooh, okay, what might it be? And so I would come up with these theories going through the temple. I mean, this is talking about later experiences going through the temple, but you know, like when Lucifer says, something about I'm only doing what's been done on other worlds. You know, I came up with this whole side theory about what that meant, and I just loved it. I thought, oh, I've got it figured out.
What was that side theory? Is that something you can share?
Oh, sure. Yeah. That actually Adam and Eve were, and this was when I still believed in kind of a literal Adam and Eve, even if it was a little bit different maybe than how the Bible said, but you know, I still had some kind of a belief in it that when God went to create a plan like this plan on this earth, there was first a probationary period where he would say, don't partake of the fruit. But then after that probationary time, he would say, okay, now you can partake of the fruit because that's how you enter into mortality and that's required. But there's not a requisite from God for sin to be the way that you enter into mortality. And in fact, the person who's supposed to give the fruit to Adam and Eve is Jesus or Jehovah. That's how it's supposed to be. And so Lucifer, who we all know fell from the war in heaven because he wanted to be like God. He wanted to play the role that you know, Jesus ultimately played. He went in as a usurper. And, you know, he saw what had been done on other worlds. And so he was saying, I'm going to do this myself. And by doing this, I'm going to become the God of this world. And because that's how, you know, other Jehovahs in other plans have become gods of other worlds. And so he did that as a usurper. And, you know, I thought, yeah, I got it figured out. But of course, God's smarter than that, because it doesn't really make him the God of this world, because he didn't factor in the atonement, and the atonement will still crush his head. You know, and that part comes up in the temple where they cast Lucifer from the midst. And I would always get that really warm, burning feeling whenever they would cast Lucifer. It was my favorite part. Well, one of my favorite parts. I also liked a lot of the performances of the devil, and like when he turns and looks at the audience and says, now you're in my power. Mm-hmm. He's the most interesting character in the whole performance. Thing. But yeah, so I found the temple experience the first time I went through, and then subsequent times I went through, I found it very compelling, very interesting. It wasn't until later years when I started studying ritual and you know, a lot of the supernatural mysteries, that supernatural part started falling away from me. Mm-hmm. And then things changed in the way that I saw it, and things became a little bit more monotonous with it and troubling, but I still had an appreciation for it, just in a different way.
Right. So. Well, that theory is pretty awesome.
Oh, thanks.
It's a
It'd make a great like fictional story, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Well, it also is a better, like, one of the things that I have a problem with is that God lied to Adam and Eve, and the devil was telling them the truth. He said that they would die, and Lucifer said, no, you won't. You'll just gain intelligence. And that's always bugged me. But your theory makes it not buggy. But anyway, so yeah your experience.
Well, but you know, and again, I mean, if you want to explore that a little bit more, I think that one of the things that we're missing today in the church, that in Joseph Smith's time and even Brigham Young's time, that they had, there was a lot more speculative theology where people could ask those questions and have those things that kind of bothered you, and then come up with solutions for it, and you could get those kinds of answers even hinted at. Mm-hmm. in a temple thing. But you know, we don't really even have an environment where you could construct a narrative to answer those questions anymore, because it's so correlated and regimented.
Right.
But you know, I've looked at some of the early things, you know, like Orson Hyde, I think it is, or maybe it's Orson Pratt who wrote The Seer. There's some fantastically bizarre stuff in those things that he wrote about, like celestial fruit. You know, that there's telestial fruit and terrestrial fruit and celestial fruit, that, you know, if you eat any of those things, that it transforms your body into that material, and that's how Michael was able to become Adam. And yeah, I mean, just like all these different things that
like an Alice in Wonderland type of thing. Like if you want to visit the terrestrial world,
And it's all based on a very literal belief that the Earth is 6,000 years old, and that it used to exist in a different sphere, and it was in its paradisiacal state, and it's fallen, but it'll return to it someday. And you know, things that today, when we look at things, we look through a lens of science and go, that is ridiculous.
Uh-huh.
But to them, it wasn't ridiculous. It was magical and completely within the realm of faith and worship and God.
Right.
You know, so at any rate, okay. How's that for a tangent?
I think it was an interesting one.
Yeah.
Okay. So your mission, you went to Japan, right?
Yeah, I went to Okayama, Japan, and my mission was a good experience for me. I was disappointed though, because I wanted to go to Russia, because my patriarchal blessing told me that I'd work with the lost tribes, or at least that's how I interpreted it, and I thought for sure that the lost tribes were in Russia. And so when I opened up my mission call and it said Okayama, Japan, I was really disappointed. And ultimately I came to appreciate it. And my experience in the MTC was kind of a drag. I could talk for hours about my mission experience. There were so many experiences that I had there, but I'll just kind of sum it up by saying that I divide it really into two parts, where the first part I kind of went in with a very Elder Price-ish, I'm incredible, I'm going to do incredible things. And towards the midway point of my mission, it turned where I started seeing other people that had similar attitudes and really despising them. Uh-huh. And then seeing that same thing in myself and despising that in myself.
Mm-hmm.
And at the beginning of my mission, you know, when I first met my mission president, he asked us what our major focus should be as missionaries. And I thought, oh, well, it's simple. It's the Japanese people. That's who we're here to convert. And he said, no, it's yourself as a missionary. And I thought, no, that's wrong. If we haven't got ourselves in order already, we shouldn't even be here. Mm-hmm. Well, what is he saying us for? You know, oh, it's because he's a convert and because he's Japanese. You know, okay, I'll give him a pass on that. You know,
right.
He's wrong. You know, I mean, so that's me, you know, the arrogant 19-year-old.
Uh-huh.
Then he said the second thing, what should we be focusing on? I'm like, oh, the Japanese people. And he's like, no, it's your companion. I'm like, oh, man, the companions, they should have figured it out before they came here. Come on, get it right, President.
Right.
And then finally, the third one was, you know, the Japanese people. And I'm like, okay, yeah, he got it right. But, you know, so
I just was in for a rude awakening, and I had quite a rude awakening the first year or so of my mission. Just had some really difficult experiences with my gung-ho. Like I was everybody's nightmare companion, because I was so overzealous. And my first companion, who I probably shouldn't say too much about because of where he works now, but He has since repented, but at the time, he was known throughout the mission as the streaking samurai, because he liked to strip down into nothing but this straw hat and a kendo sword and run through the neighborhood late at night just for kicks. And he had a Polaroid that he showed me when I first got in. And this guy was the zone leader. And I found out very quickly that he was kind of the ringleader of this small clique of wild missionaries that, you know, I thought they were like the Gadianton robbers of my mission. And so I thought it was my call and duty to
straighten everybody out.
Straighten them out, you know. And yeah, we clashed.
But then in the second half of my mission, I ended up with these two guys who we were in a companionship, the three of us together. And as I got to know them, they really weren't interested in converting the Japanese people. That wasn't the primary reason they came on their mission. It was because before their mission, they had been, you know, heavily involved in, you know, drugs and alcohol and girls, and had seen the path that it would put them on, or, you know, whatever they thought it would put them on. And it kind of scared them into wanting to straighten their life up. And so they looked at the mission as kind of a boot camp. Mm-hmm. And, you know, whereas a year earlier, I would have thought that was a completely wrong reason to go on a mission. I thought, okay, yeah, this is good. These are good guys. I like them. They're cool guys. And the other guys in the mission that were running around with all of the energy and zeal that I started my mission with, I just thought they were weenies. And you know, they like this one guy, I just got to tell the story. They all wanted power. They wanted to be zone leaders and district leaders and APs. And you know, this one guy, he was his companion. They were riding to go meet the mission president, and his companion had an accident on his bike. He fell and he scraped up his knee really bad. And his companion, who was this little ambitious guy that wanted to be AP and impress the mission president, instead of stopping to help his companion, he just left him there so that he wouldn't be late for the meeting with the mission president. And I just thought, you know, that's stupid. That's completely against all of these messages that we're supposed to be teaching about charity and love. And would Jesus do that? You know, and you know, then a few weeks later, I had a companion at this time who was suffering from chronic fatigue syndrome. And, you know, he would be completely out of energy by about 7:30 in the morning. And he would just go back to sleep and sleep the rest of the day. And it was absolutely miserable for me. Summer months, totally hot. I was just stuck in the apartment. And so I asked this guy who was a zone leader if I could go on splits with him. We were supposed to be doing some baptismal interviews at the church that night. And he just refused to do splits with me because he wanted to kind of force this chronic fatigue syndrome missionary to get off his lazy butt and get out there and do some work. Because if he had real faith, then he'd be healed. We had this conversation once. It really pissed me off. So anyway, he wouldn't do the split with me. And, you know, by the time we got to the church that night, my companion was just in such bad shape. I was so upset with this guy. Mm-hmm. And he could tell when he saw me. And he was like, oh, is there anything wrong? And I kind of launched into him a little bit. And he just looked at me and he stormed out of the room. And, you know, it was this big tiff. We did the interviews for this couple that was going to get baptized. And, you know, then we got back to the apartment that night. He comes in and you know, as he's walking in the door, I say, you know, Elder Williams, I'm sorry. You know, I shouldn't have launched into you that way. And he goes, no, we need to talk. And he closes the door and he comes and he goes, you know, there's a time and a place for everything.
Oh,
and right before a baptismal interview is no time to introduce the spirit of contention into our lives. He said, do you know what is at stake in these baptismal interviews? We have to get a confirmation from the Holy Ghost that these people are worthy to be baptized, or it's damnation for them and for us. He goes, do you know why I'm late? I'm late because I had to stop my interview. I had to stop my interview mid-interview and go into the chapel and pray to have the spirit of contention lifted from me because of what you introduced. And I'm just like looking at him this whole time like, are you an idiot? You know, and so he goes, so how did your interview go? Like, it was fine. It was great. Oh, really? And the spirit confirmed to you that she's ready to be baptized? Yeah. Yeah, great. He goes, oh, wow. It's amazing you're able to have both spirits with you at the same time.
Wow.
And my fist was just clenched, and I was just, you know, oh, it was all the restraint I could have not to just show him both spirits. But but anyway, you know, so it was experiences like that where I'm looking at these guys and going, I don't want to be like that.
Right.
That's not how I want to be. And I think they're totally missing the point. They're so stuck on the object that they're missing what it's what it's supposed to be symbolizing, which mm-hmm. is love. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I couldn't articulate it like that back then, but I could at least recognize it. And so I started making, I think, a shift away from where I had been earlier. Yeah, so that was my mission experience. Like I said, I could talk about, I've got a million stories like that.
Right. But you started to see that people were using the church or their faith to get them other things rather than, you know, for the purpose of that the church puts forth itself.
Yeah. And I don't want to say everybody does that, or that everybody does it in a negative way, but, you know, there certainly are people who do it. I just started seeing how very human everything was. And, you know, I mentioned earlier that, you know, these stories I was hearing on my mission got me interested in folklore. And that's when I finished my mission, I went to BYU, I got interested in studying folklore. And, that kind of put me on this path where I just started seeing, the fingerprints of human creation over on everything. And, just the traditions that we have in our beliefs and our customs and our practices, the stories that we tell, the words that we say, songs, scriptures, clothes that we wear, food that we eat, all of our culture that's just man-made, and how similar it is in function. Even if it isn't similar in form, it's similar in function to so many religions all around the world, and not even religions. I mean, just so many human inventions and conventions that we have. You know, I would look at things like, there's this woman named Elizabeth Loftus who is, I think she's at the University of Washington, and she's done studies with memory. If anybody out there is interested, Google Elizabeth Loftus and look at things. I think one of her studies was Lost in a Shopping Mall. It's just this fascinating study on how malleable memory is, mm-hmm. and people can create false memories. Mm-hmm. And that just blew my mind. You know, if people can create false memories, and I was already learning about how people take actual experiences and they select certain events to create a narrative and tell a narrative that has a point, and it's usually a point that's going to justify or validate some belief that they have that's part of a larger narrative that they want to fit into. Mm-hmm. And you take that and you combine that with the ability to alter your memories, and wow, you know, and then looking at things like UFO abduction stories, the way that it works there, a memorat is a particular type of personal experience with the supernatural. And there are these narratives that I study called old hag narratives, where people have it's like sleep. When they're asleep, they wake up in the middle of the night and they feel like this heavy thing has been on their chest, uh-huh. mm-hmm. like it's been sitting on their chest and it lifts. And sometimes it's interpreted as a malevolent spirit. And so that's why it's called old hag. That's actually where the term nightmare comes from. And, you know, so I was learning all of these things, and it just opened my eyes to what the culture was that I grew up in.
So it looked less divine and more man-made.
Completely man-made. And, you know, that's not to say that there isn't good in it. Of course there's good in it. I mean, but it's the good that man and women put into it. And just as there's good that we can put into it, there's bad that can be put into it, you know, so it can be abused. And you know, looking at symbols, you know, we'll talk about symbols, and we'll talk about how baptism is a symbol for things, or that the sacrament is a symbol for things. But I just think that humans are way too prone to start worshiping the item, you know, whatever it is that's actually symbolizing mm-hmm. the mm-hmm. thing, and
rather than the idea,
forget about what's being represented, and start focusing on, you know, that's idolatry. And so I just started mm-hmm. seeing that happening so much, and you know, a culture of hero worship with our leaders and the hierarchy in the church, mm-hmm. That is just a very human phenomena, but it's kind of dangerous and unhealthy. And, you know, I just found myself wanting to go around to people and go, hey, wake up, look at this. Do you see what's going on? And, you know, not finding very many people all that receptive to that message.
Right. They weren't analyzing the situation, really.
Yeah, yeah. Weren't really thinking about it. And you know, feeling very threatened by any kinds of questions about something that's sacred to them, which right. I can completely understand.
So when you got back, you went to BYU, or?
Yep. Yeah, and
how was going to BYU?
Well, I liked BYU much better before my mission than after my mission, because it was just a different experience being single at BYU than being married at BYU. But I thought it was fine. You know, I've listened, and I've told John DeLynn this a couple times. I've listened to his interview with Joanna Brooks, and I overlapped with her a little bit. That there were things that were going on the campus at that time. Like, I had Gail Houston as an English teacher, and I just was so not plugged into anything that was happening. Like, I didn't know about September 6th, and I was there right as it was going on. And,
oh, wow.
And yeah, I look back now and just, I kind of kick myself for it. Mm-hmm. You know, so I wish I would have been more aware. Well, there was another one I listened to with Bill Bradshaw, and he was talking about some of the symposia or some of the workshops that he would have or presentations that were just open to anybody that they could come. And I just really didn't take advantage of that stuff. And so I wish I would have more. I just kind of floated through BYU, really.
Gotcha. But it wasn't you didn't feel religiously oppressed, or, you know what I mean? Like, a lot of people really chafe at the experience of being BYU.
Well, I, you know, I got a beard card.
So, I remember you telling me this.
Yeah, so I was like one of the few guys on campus walking around with a beard, because I just thought it was so stupid. I went to the testing center one day with a 5 o'clock shadow, and they turned me away. I was like, who are these little Nazis standing behind a desk telling me that I can't go in and take a test because I've got stubble? Like, really? That's what we're doing here? You know, it just reminded me of these weenies that were running around my mission wanting to be AP. And so I just thought, okay, well, I guess what you have to do is go to the health center and scuff up your face a little bit with a razor blade, pluck down $20 and say, okay, give me a card for a beard. You know,
so if your skin was sensitive enough, you could get like medical permission.
Yeah.
To not shave.
Yeah, you could get a beard card and wear a beard around BYU, and of course everybody, you know, would look at me like, okay, what's he trying to prove? Why is he different? You know, or whatever.
But you were married at that point, right?
Yeah, so I wasn't trying to find a wife. So
right.
Yeah, what did I care?
No, right. But so you weren't. You know, I mean, I wonder if you had been single and had the beard card,
it wouldn't have made
a difference. Like impacted your ability to date. They would have looked at you as, you know, like a heathen.
Maybe it would have filtered out the just the right element, and I would have found. I don't know. It wouldn't have stopped what I was doing. I didn't really care that much. But I think, you know, with the teachers that I had, I remember walking into some classes and just, you know, on the first day, some of the looks that I would get, you know, just like, okay, I don't know. I mean, and I also don't know how much is this now, looking back, you know, some, you know, 15, 20 years later and going and reading into it. I don't know. And how much was it just at the time I was being overly sensitive to it? They might not have cared at all. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Well, you would probably stuck out with a sore thumb.
Yeah, there weren't that many guys on campus with a beard, but yeah. You know, I for the most part, I liked BYU. I felt like it was really stupid. I majored in English. I was planning on becoming a lawyer. because that's what my dad was. And so I thought I'll get an English degree. And so I just thought it was stupid being in English classes and studying about Shakespeare and have the discussion turn towards Nephi. Like, why are we talking about Nephi in the Book of Mormon and trying to compare everything to Nephi in the Book of Mormon? And it just came up. It was so pervasive everywhere. Mm-hmm. And that became annoying. And when I left BYU and went to graduate school, I felt personally that I hadn't been very prepared at BYU. Now, I've talked with people who feel that BYU prepared them very well, and mm-hmm. and so I think it was probably just my own lack of discipline, because I probably had things around me that I just didn't take advantage of, you know, like I mentioned earlier.
Right.
So while I was at BYU, I got interested in folklore, and I started working at the folklore archives for Burt Wilson. I did that for a year and a half, and then he pointed me out to Indiana University, which is one of the only degree-granting programs in the country, and that's why mm-hmm. I came to Bloomington, which is where I am now. And yeah, I got a master's degree, and then I finished all the coursework, started writing my dissertation, and then, you know, midway through writing my dissertation, the dissertation was on Mormon humor, and, you know, I was getting disillusioned with it, because the things that I was discovering, I didn't feel like I could really talk about it, or that people, like my intended audience, really wanted to hear what I had to say. Just an example of that. And I may have shared this on the Mormon Humor interview podcast uh-huh. that, you know, was the first one that I did with John way back uh-huh. when. But there was a guy who had been a stake president. He had been a bishop. He had been all these things. And I was interviewing him as one of my sample subjects for the dissertation. And, you know, part of my methodology is I would sit down with groups of people that were in the ward, or, you know, Mormons locally in Bloomington, and we would – I would read them different jokes, and then I would ask them to rate them. You know, what did they think? If it was very funny, you know, not funny, or offensive. And it was this joke about a bishopric that goes up into the mountains, and, you know, the bishop says, when I'm up in the mountains, I just have to have a nice cold beer. And the first counselor says, oh, I'm with you, Bishop. I've got to pull up a cup of coffee. And the second counselor says, oh, I've always got to have a cigar. And the executive secretary, they all look at him, waiting for him to say something. He goes, oh, well, yeah, I do have a vice. I'm a terrible gossip. I can't wait to get back to the ward and tell everybody what you guys just said. And, you know, the reaction when I said that, this guy's whole family, they all laughed, including him. And so I asked him to rate it, and he goes, oh, well, yeah, that's not funny.
But
he was laughing the whole time, and I was thinking, okay, well, so what does that laughter mean? And he started explaining to me why it wasn't funny. It wasn't funny because, you know, I've been a bishop, and I know what they go through, and they're really good people. They mean well, so you should never put them down. And, you know, actually, you know, change my answer. That's offensive. Yeah, that's offensive. And so, you know, I started just kind of seeing that anything that I said about Mormon humor and like the ways that, like, if I started talking about Mormon identity through humor, I was going to be setting myself up for a lot of arguments, you know, like I wasn't going to be talking about people the way that they wanted to be seen. And, you know, I still had some stupid aspirations that maybe I would work at BYU. I might get hired at BYU or BYU Idaho or something like that. And I started realizing, no, they're not going to want me because I'm not going to want to do these faith promoting, affirming things. That's not who I am. That's not what this is about. And, I don't know. I just lost a lot of the ambition for that. And then I got an opportunity for a different career, and I took it. So I'd never finished the dissertation on Mormon humor.
So you didn't really have a crisis of faith then, where you were trotting along as a believer and then something happened to ruin that for you? You kind of just, I don't know, had the scales fall from your eyes slowly? Is that how you would describe it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. And, you know, for me, like, I grew up with this healthy curiosity for supernatural mysteries. And as things became less supernatural, the curiosity didn't abate. I was still just as curious. It was just I was now curious in the natural mysteries. And, mm-hmm. and especially when you look at the mysteries in the way that people use religion to communicate with each other, and especially Mormonism as a way to communicate with each other or define identity or to find their own meaning in the world. I found that very interesting. Mm-hmm. But I would have experiences personally, you know, like I described a few of them on my mission that would cause me to, you know, I guess open my eyes a little bit. It just exposed the humanness of religion and things with my parents divorcing was a big influence in my life with this because I was 24 years old when my parents divorced and my mom claimed she doesn't remember it now that this is how malleable memory is. Mm-hmm. But she claimed that she was told in the Mesa Temple, or at least had this feeling of confirmed from the Lord that she should divorce my dad. And so it's basically, you know, this is what God wants me to do.
Right.
And, you know, my dad would tell me, oh, no, I prayed about this. This is not what God wants me to do. And, you know, your mom's talked with the bishop. She's talked with the stake president, and they've confirmed that this is not what God wants her to do. You know, her priesthood leaders have said this is not what God wants her to do. Mm-hmm. And, of course, I didn't want them to divorce either. So, yeah, that's not what I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. But, you know, so I started seeing, you know, how what God wanted was so perfectly lined up with what my dad wanted. And what God wanted was also so perfectly lined up with what my mom wanted, but they were so mutually exclusive. And, you know, what's behind that? Because they were both equally convinced that God, and so sincere in their experiences with it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And, you know, so, and I'm not comfortable even to this day of belittling people's experiences that are sacred. You know, because I've had experiences that are special, sacred. I can't explain them experiences. You know, some of them, you know, just like warm, fuzzy feelings. Yeah. But I've had other things happen to me that have been a little more powerful that, I don't know exactly what it was or behind it, but you know, I don't want to just discount things, mm-hmm. For people. But at the same time, you know, there's a lot of man-made stuff going on in the way that we interpret things that we don't understand and kind of bend them to fit our own desires. I mean, so that's kind of what I see.
Okay.
And where my okay. path went, I guess.
So you didn't have an event where you learned something about the church and so it just brought everything crashing down?
No. No.
It was more like the church just wasn't living up to what you needed it to be, to believe in it. Do you know what I mean? It wasn't meeting like your criteria. Not that you had explicit criteria.
Oh, I don't know. I think that my criteria for it gradually changed, and it was meeting what I needed it to be. And I think, you know, if we skip ahead to where I am right now, it's mm-hmm. just like where I am right now, there's not really that much that I need it for anymore. But at the time, you know, as we're talking about in this narrative of my life, you know, that up to this point, there were things that I was needing it for and kind of using it for, it was more that I started recognizing that it had this utilitarian function, I stopped feeling obligated to it, if that makes any sense. You know, I didn't feel like the bishop had control over me, you know, or that the mm-hmm. brethren had control over me, or that, you know, God was leading them and what they said was the final word. It was more, okay, you know, this is what it is, and this is how I can use it and how it adds value to my life. And that might sound really cynical, but I really felt a genuine value to it, that there is a value to it. And maybe that value is God. And, you know, so, you know, I think there was a balance there between belief and doubt that was quite utilitarian.
So are there other formative, I guess, type experiences that happened to you in your adult life, or where did your loss of faith, I guess, take you? How did that impact how your life has unfolded?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I never looked at it as a loss of faith. I always looked at it as a redefinition of faith. And mm-hmm. even, you know, even now, you'd be hard pressed to get me to admit that I have lost faith, because I still think of myself as a hopeful person, almost to the point of being naive sometimes in my hopes, because I still sometimes hope for things that aren't real, and have to remind myself that okay, wait a second, what's actually real here, and am I setting myself up for something that's going to disappoint me? Mm-hmm. You know, but so I think I'm still a faithful person in a lot of ways, but so you're asking me about my beliefs in Mormonism or
Wondering how your life has unfolded. Like, what is your? We've kind of discussed how, you know, your faith changed, but does that really encompass the entire experience you've had with Mormonism? Like, what were there events that happened through your adult years that you wanted to touch upon as part of your story?
Well, I'm recently divorced, that, you know, we're recording this in October 2011, mm-hmm. and I was divorced in May. And, you know, my ex-wife and I were married for 17 years, temple marriage, three fantastic kids. It's not one of those typical marriages where, you know, she's a TBM and I'm a questioner, and so we struggled with that. She, you know, there's a little bit of that in there, but not a lot. When I started doing the podcast, you know, a year and a half ago or whenever I started, she was encouraging of that. She was glad that I found a place to talk about the things, because she was tired of hearing about it herself. You know, mm-hmm. she was never really as interested in these kinds of things as I was. But, I think that the times when we struggled in our marriage, like we saw five different therapists over the course of maybe 8 years. Mm-hmm. So we really tried to make things work between the two of us. And we took the advice that bishops gave us and the advice that our sealer when we were married in the temple gave to us. And, you know, times where we would be arguing about something, and I'd say, okay, let's kneel down and pray and really try to bring the Lord into this. Mm-hmm. And, you know, sincere. I wasn't cynically using it as a way to shut her up. I was sincere about it, but it just didn't do anything. It didn't help. And, you know, there's this hymn, "Where Can I Turn for Peace?" That has become a really empty, haunting hymn for me, because there were many frustrated nights where I would lay on the side of my bed pleading to the Lord for some kind of peace and comfort from the Holy Ghost, you know, which mm-hmm. I was given as a gift when I was 8 years old, wanting to come and comfort me and feel like I was not alone, and just feeling nothing. And so then doing this personal inventory of worthiness. You know, what am I not doing right, or what am I not doing enough? And it just became exhausting. And you know, then it's like, oh, is it because I'm doubting? Is it because I'm questioning? Is it because I think critically? Is that right. What it is? Is this the curse of Boyd K. Packer coming on me? You know, and if so, come on, is that really what this is about? You know, mm-hmm. So you know, I think that's probably as formative as anything in, you know, adult experience. But it's just over a long period of time. You know, I as a folklorist, I learned to be a participant observer in Mormon culture, and I took that very seriously, where I would participate very faithfully, even if that faith was nothing more than just a desire to believe, which I think Alma talks about in, mm-hmm. you know, the Plant the Seed chapter 32. And, you know, so I had callings like executive secretary, gospel doctrine teacher, ward mission leader, and, you know, magnified those, did the best I could, try to keep, you know, especially when I was gospel doctrine teacher, tried to keep them interesting and engaging. And, you know, there were times I would push the envelope a little bit and make some people uncomfortable, but, you know, that kept it fun. Right. So I think, you know, there was just kind of a gradual realization that the things that I wanted to have work for me weren't working for me spiritually, you know, feeling that connection mm-hmm. with God, that guidance. And
so yeah. While you believed that all of these things were rituals created by mankind, did you still believe in a God?
Well, sure. Well, yeah, because there's the scripture that says that God speaks to man in his own language. And so I was able to lump ritual into language and say, this is just another one of these ways that God is communicating with us. And it's not that different from the way that Christ would teach in parables. And, you know, so we've got these rituals that symbolize things, and they're created by man, and maybe they're just Dumbo's black feather that's uh-huh. teaching us to unlock the potential that we have inside of us anyway. What does that have to do with God one way or the other?
Mm-hmm. Okay. So it doesn't negate the possibility of there being a God?
No. No.
Are you still in that camp?
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, and actually I like the, boy, I'm going to get a lot of flack for saying this. I think that Mike said something pretty eloquent on, I think it was one of the Articles of Faith, podcasts that I was listening to a week or so ago, when he was explaining God's rationale why he doesn't get involved and fix everybody's problems for them. Uh-huh. You know, that God is a distant God because he wants to see, or he needs to see, or because we need to see for ourselves how we're going to respond in a vacuum. Are we going to be good and charitable and kind to each other just because it's the right thing to do? Or are we going to be compelled to do it even just because we think somebody's watching, or, you know, for whatever. And he didn't say it exactly that way, but I do like that Mormonism that explains God that way. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, it's not completely convincing to me. But, you know, I can waffle back and forth on that and feel pretty comfortable. There isn't anything that has happened that has convinced me that there's no God. And I don't think that there has to be. I don't know. Hmm. It depends what day you ask me, Heather.
Okay.
It depends what day.
So are you active now?
No, I went to church last week because it was our primary program. But I really haven't been, I don't have a calling. I don't have any home teachers that, or home teachees that I'm assigned. So I've been kind of put on the inactive list, I think, in my elders quorum. I haven't attended really since the divorce, but that's mainly because it's just painful to be there. When we divorced, I moved into a house that's just down the street to, in the same neighborhood, same ward. It makes it easy for our kids to go back and forth. And, so to sit in church and to look around at all of the young families there and, see their hopes and dreams for what they have together as a family. Mm-hmm. And it just reminds me of what I had and wanted ours to be, but didn't realize that. And it's still kind of fresh and painful. And to be honest, I didn't like going before. Mm-hmm. So, I really haven't gotten that much out of going to church for a long time. And it was something I would do just because it's what we do. And, so there's not a lot of incentive to really go. Mm-hmm. I like the ward that I'm in. There's a lot of great people in the ward that I'm in, and I like the bishop in the ward. I just had lunch with him the other day. We had some interesting discussions, and he asked me about my plans to come back, more regularly. Mm-hmm. And, I don't know how much he knows of podcasting or Mormon Expression. One of the counselors that he had was a regular listener, but mm-hmm. I don't know that he knows much about it. He understands why. With the divorce, it's difficult for me to be there.
Right. So do you hope that changes in the future? Do you hope you find a way to be back in the church and be comfortable?
Not really. The thing that's hard about that is my kids, because, I've got a daughter who's 14, another who's 11, and then a son who's 7 who gets baptized in January.
Mm-hmm.
And that, looking at that is rough, because that's going to be something that more likely than not his grandfather is going to be doing.
Right.
That's going to be hard for him. And we've started having discussions about that already. And it's kind of been difficult for my daughters to imagine me having baptized them, but not baptizing my son.
Uh-huh.
And, they have, especially my oldest daughter has some issues and some struggles with what she's going through, with the church as well, but I don't want to be a source of conflict to her,
mm-hmm.
as she's struggling. And so I find it difficult. I don't have any simple answers to where it is, to what to do, because on the one hand, I don't want them going to church and being programmed in certain ways that are going to come back to bite me in the butt,
uh-huh.
or bite themselves in the butt, really. I mean, to be honest, that's my main concern. But at the same time, I don't really see that happening with them. I don't know that happened with me. And I think, any of us that listen to Mormon Expression, we were able to see something different, weren't we? This programming or brainwashing or whatever it is, mm-hmm. that we get afraid of from the church, is it really something that we need to be afraid of? That's something that I'm not convinced that it is. And maybe I'll be proven wrong there, but maybe I have a unique ward. So I think my kids' involvement right now with it, I don't feel any need to go and sabotage their involvement or to pull them out or yank them out. My future involvement in church, I've got some really good friends there. And if I could find a way to make it work where I could be comfortable going, I could see that happening, but maybe, but not to the point, not to the point where I'd have to, like start paying tithing or, you know, like I could be one of those guys that shows up and gives support for his kids and, mm-hmm. you know, maybe grows a beard someday and, you know, like one of those guys, but, you know, says something interesting in Elders Quorum every once in a while, but you know, I'll never be like that full fellowship or full membership.
Gospel doctrine teacher.
Yeah, that sucks because I loved that calling, man. That was fun.
Right.
I was good at that.
Okay. Well, is there anything related to Mormon Expression that you wanted to talk about? Did you want to tell the audience how and why you became involved?
Well, how and why I became involved. Well, I started emailing. I just started listening to the podcast, really. I was looking on the iTunes store for any kind of Mormon content with podcasting because I was traveling a lot. And, you know, I had listened to Mormon Stories for a while, and then I saw Mormon Expression and thought, oh, I'd give that a chance. I'd listened to whatever the Van Hale one was. And
The Church Is Not True? Was that what that one was?
No, I think that one's different. No, I don't know that. I think maybe I've heard a few of those.
Okay.
But, yeah, I didn't really like the Van Halen ones, but maybe I didn't listen to the right ones, but Mormon Expression really grabbed me from the start, because I liked the irreverent humor and I liked the sense that, you know, there was a community of people that they really seemed to get along, even when they disagreed with each other. They could kind of laugh it off and have discussions about the church and gospel topics in ways that I always wished that my Elders Quorum would have discussed it. Mm-hmm. And any question could be asked. You could talk about you could raise things without having somebody call you on contention and go, oh, you're raising the spirit of contention. That's off limits. You can't talk about that.
Right.
I always hated that sort of thing. So Mormon Expression was great. And, you know, I listened to several, and I was living in Japan at this time. I was living in Tokyo. And, so I just emailed John, as probably many people do, and just told him a little bit about my background and said, I, you know, pardon me. And so I emailed John and told him that I have a PhD in folklore, mm-hmm. where I didn't finish the dissertation, but everything else is done. And that was on Mormon humor. So if you ever wanted to talk about Mormon humor, we could do that. Or I did this thing on the Lost Tribes. I've always been interested in the Lost Tribes. We could do something like that. And I probably wrote like 5,000 words in an email to John. And if anybody knows John Larson, you just don't write 5,000 word emails to John Larson. It took me a while to figure that out, but you know, and he'd write back what I thought were very terse responses, like, sounds good. You know, so it's like, and I was very unsatisfied with that response. I wanted more, you know, but you know, so he scheduled a date and I was so confused. Because he's like, okay, yeah, let's try that for, you know, the 17th of February or whenever it was. And I couldn't tell. Did he tell me that we were going to do it? Did we not? I need more information here. And so then I'm like, okay, all right. So what are we going to talk about? Are we going to talk about Mormon humor? Okay, so if we're going to talk about Mormon humor, we could talk about incongruity theory. We could talk about superiority theory. We could talk about this. I could give these examples. And I started sending me all these emails and more. I don't think he even opened them, you know. Yeah, and even, I mean, to be honest with you, even up to 1 hour before I went on the podcast, I didn't know if it was going to happen or not. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know who was going to be on. So and that was, I don't know what the episode number was. I think it's like 48 or something.
Yeah, you were near 50.
Is it 50? Mm-hmm. The Mormon humor.
I just remember you started being on around episode 50.
Yeah. And that was Tom and Garen, who was just going by George back then, and Zilpha and John. And, you know, I was a little, starstruck, you know. Uh-huh. I was talking to these guys that I wanted to ask them for their autograph, and, you know. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it was just kind of a fun experience to talk with them. And it drove me nuts afterwards because I wanted to hear it back so bad, and it was like 3 weeks before it came out.
Right.
So the next time, when I was able, what I did for the second one was because I had a contact at BYU in the folklore department. He asked me to write a book review for a book that had come out on the Lost Tribes of Israel, that I've never written actually, but he sent me a copy of the book, and I thought it was an interesting book. And Mormon Expression had done their thing on Occult America with Mitch Horowitz, and so I said, "Hey, John, I bet I could get this author to come on, and we could talk about the Lost Tribes. Would you be interested in that?" And he said, "Okay." So I contacted the author, and he was in Paris, and you know, I was in Japan, and John was in North Carolina, and we set up a time. And because I had been so frustrated that I couldn't hear myself back the first time, I got some recording equipment just so I could record it and have, you know, listen to myself how it went afterwards. And there was a mix up on the times, and John wasn't able to get on, and so I found myself on with this this author, and
kind
I wasn't
of like
really
you
prepared.
Did to me.
Did I do that to you? Oh,
yeah.
with
Campbell and Campbell, American yeah. Grace.
Yeah, pay it forward, baby. Pay it forward, and yeah. So I just went forward with the interview since I had him on, and it was so hard to schedule it, mm-hmm. and. I had the recording equipment and got it done. And then as soon as I finished, John popped onto Skype and he goes, "All right, I'm ready to go." I'm like, "Oh, we just finished up." And, so I kind of cleared that. He said, "All right, well, we'll do this. We'll publish it as one interview with him and then a discussion with the panelists." Uh-huh. And, so then we did that. That's why that one, with the Lost Tribes, there's the interview with him and then the panelist discussion. And then I just left the thing running afterwards, what I was recording, and had this after show discussion, which I thought was fantastic. And I listened back to it, and because I'm just a fan at this point who's lucky enough to get to talk to John and Zilpha and, Mike Tannehill, the crazy guy that I was always yelling at through my iPod, and here's John taking him to task in this after show that nobody else is going to get to hear but me. Mm-hmm. And so I put it together, and I said, "John, you've got to publish this thing. This is gold, man. It's gold." He's like, "I don't know. People don't like this stuff." I'm like, "Yeah, they do. They do.
Oh,
they do.
Yeah,
publish
they,
it."
Yes,
so it's always been, this... I think friendly point of contention between John and I about, oh, is Glenn recording right now? Because I left it recording during the after show, which usually they felt was safe time because no one was recording. But
right. So did that make it on air?
So that's how I came on and just started doing things more regularly.
Did that ever make it to air?
Yeah, it's there.
I don't remember it. I'll have to try to go back and find it.
It's fantastic. John takes Mike to task on this whole thing about resurrected bodies and how it just doesn't make any sense. And, Tom gets a few good looks in and Zilpha gets a few good zingers in, but it's just, I just thought that John was in such great form and, him going back and forth with Mike was so fun. So, mm-hmm.
Well, those are the audience favorite episodes, I think, when John's on a tear and Mike's on.
Yeah.
So anything else you wanted to cover for this conversation?
No, I think I'll save what I'm going to be doing in the millennium for another discussion.
Well, I've covered the past and the present. Shouldn't we cover the future?
Yeah, I've got my Seer Stone open, but I'm going to close that app. And
those will be like the bound pages of the Book of Mormon.
Yeah, why haven't we gotten those yet? And why haven't we got the Book of Joseph that was supposed to be published with the Book of Abraham? You know, those were the things for me. You know, like the Book of Abraham was a big thing for me. Joseph Smith's polygamy was a big thing for me. Just DNC 132 was a big thing for me. When I started seeing those things and going, yeah, you know, man-made. Yeah, man-made. Mm-hmm. And man, he's kind of a bastard there when he's doing that too. And, you know, like I had grown up with this really healthy love for Joseph Smith that Truman Madsen had instilled in me in those tapes that Truman Madsen did that I loved. Mm-hmm. And then I started finding out these other things that I'm like, oh man, this is tarnishing this guy that was a hero of mine. I'm not sure I really like this, but at the same time, you know, how can you ignore it? And now it's hard for me to look at things that Joseph Smith does without a cynical eye.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost impossible to look at it without a cynical eye.
And a cynical eye meaning that he was out for his own power and gain, and that he was
a charlatan? Oh, yeah. Like, what was he trying to get out of this? You know, like, why? You know. You know, the missionaries can't swim on their missions, and there's this scripture in the DNC that the destroyer rides upon the waters or something like that. Mm-hmm. That, you know, the devil has power over the waters, and so that's used as justification for why missionaries can't swim on their missions. Well, the whole reason that's in the DNC is because when Joseph Smith took his group from Kirtland to Jackson County to check up on Oliver Cowdery's progress, he didn't want to walk back. He wanted to take a stagecoach. And so the Lord gave a revelation that everybody in that party was supposed to contribute all of their money to Joseph Smith to be able to get a stagecoach back to Kirtland while they walked. And it had to be a stagecoach. It couldn't be a ferry boat because the destroyer rides upon the waters. That's why that's in there in the DNC, and we're using it to justify why missionaries don't swim on their missions.
Wow.
You know, it's things like this that now I read stuff in the Doctrine and Covenants that I never thought before, you know, and so these little scripture mastery things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like it's not meet that ye should be commanded in all things, for the same as a slothful, not a wise servant. I look at that now very cynically and think, all right, who was he saying this to, and what was he trying to get out of it?
Right.
Like now I'm all about, I want to know the context behind how these things came about. Or you know, I thought the podcast that was done a while back, the DNC 19 for Dummies with Martin Harris, was just fantastic. And it's a perfect example of, mm-hmm. you know, Joseph Smith needs something. What is it? He needs money to publish the Book of Mormon, and Martin's already agreed to cough up half of it, but now he needs the rest. And, you know, Martin Harris is a guy who, you remember the three witnesses, he wasn't with the other two because he felt unworthy.
Mm-hmm.
And he's always felt unworthy. He's always felt insignificant and always been so completely terrified of hellfire and damnation. So let's give Martin a revelation that there is no hell. There's no hell, Martin. And this is a private thing that you just need to keep to yourself.
Right.
You know, without any foresight that this is going to be published in the Doctrine and Covenants for, you know, 180 years later, you know, but, you know, here, Martin, here's a little nugget for you. Oh, and by the way, here's the cost of this revelation. You know, so it's just so hard.
Yeah.
Now, is that what actually happened? I don't know. But
right.
it's just hard for me to not go there.
Well, I completely agree. I've said to several of my friends who know that I'm no longer a believer, but I don't go into why. I tell them the only question that remains for me is, is Joseph Smith a charlatan, or did he believe that what he was doing was real? And those stories kind of depress me, because in my mind they point more to him being a charlatan than actually thinking he was a prophet and receiving, you know, those types of instructions.
Yeah, and some of the most damning things for me have not come from any kind of anti-Mormon sources or anything that somebody could point to as anti-Mormon. Mm-hmm. You know, I told you this experience earlier, where as a gospel doctrine teacher, I wanted to give an etymology to the class for celestial, terrestrial, and telestial. And, mm-hmm. and I, you know, we were studying the Doctrine and Covenants, but I wanted to go to Corinthians and say, hey, this is where it all came from. This is the Joseph Smith thing. And, you know, when I looked it up, celestial meant heavens. And I just thought, oh, well, duh. Of course. I went to an elementary school called Kyrene del Cielo. I knew that meant sky. Uh-huh. And then terra, terrestrial, it means earth. Mm-hmm. I knew that one too. But in my Mormon-formed mind, I had always linked celestial with the sun, and I had always linked terrestrial with the moon, and I had always linked telestial with the stars. And so to link celestial with heaven and terrestrial with earth was just a foreign concept to me. So it was just kind of this aha moment. And then I wanted to know where telestial came from. What does it mean? And you can't find it anywhere. Mm-hmm. You try to look in an Oxford dictionary or any, I mean, it just doesn't exist. Joseph Smith invented it. And when you look in Corinthians and Paul, it's not there in Paul. So the Joseph Smith translation superimposes telestial onto Paul. And what Paul is talking about is the immortality of Christ. And it's this question, is Christ going to be resurrected, if I'm remembering it right, but he's talking about death and resurrection, and so it's this duality, and he paints it in two different columns, where there's an earthly column that's all about mortality and corruption, and then there's a heavenly column that's all about immortality and incorruption and perfection, and you know, in one you've got Adam, and then the other one you've got Christ, and you know. One is terrestrial, which is earthly, and one is celestial. Mm. And in the terrestrial one, he gives examples of different types of terrestrial bodies, like the bodies of flesh, man, beast, birds, fowl. And then in the heavenly one, he gives examples of different celestial bodies, sun, moon, stars. Mm-hmm. And I went, hang on a second. So sun and moon and stars are all examples of celestial beings. Mm-hmm. Or celestial, whatever. It's not like linking it up. That's, anyway, it just blew it apart, because telestial didn't fit this dual setup that was already there in 1 Corinthians. And the Joseph Smith translation, when you read it and you try to superimpose telestial and try to make it fit, like where do you put a third column? You've got corruption and incorruption, and what is the telestial column doing?
It's
for you
not
here?
Even the middle column either.
No, it it's based on this faulty reading of sun, moon, and stars that are all examples of the celestial thing,
right?
And you know, so I looked at that and I went, I had to ask myself a very uncomfortable question at the time. Was, am I smarter than Joseph Smith? And it kind of tapped into that whole hero worship thing, where I'm like, whoa, I couldn't possibly be smarter than Joseph Smith, because he was the prophet in all caps. Mm-hmm. And then I just kind of went, but I'm seeing this, I'm recognizing this. And no one was able to explain this to me. I took this to so many people who I respected and just asked them, can you help me understand this? And no one had a clue. Help me understand how the Joseph Smith translation adds anything to this. And you know, this was one thing where, you know, we're told to feast on the scriptures, and I started choking on a bone.
Right. And it was all sources that you were supposed to be using to shore up your testimony.
Yeah, I mean, the only source outside the scriptures that I was going to was like an Oxford English dictionary to try and get the origin of words.
Well, there you know, go.
It wasn't
anti-Mormon right there.
Yeah, right. Right. It wasn't like I was going to Webster, that little black kid. I mean, come on.
Oh boy. All right. Well, anything else you wanted to go on a tangent about? Because they're quite interesting.
I think I better end it at Webster.
All right. Well, maybe it would have been a problem pre-78, but you know, we're living in a modern day.
Yes.
All right. Well, thanks for coming on Voices, Glenn. I think a lot of people will be excited to finally hear your story. It's been a while since you've joined and haven't had your story put out here yet. So
I've had bits and pieces of it here and there. So.
Yeah, happens as you're
on. thanks for bringing me on, Heather.
Yeah. The conversation will continue at MormonExpression.com/voices.
And letting go has not been easy. But I don't need you loving me for who you think I should be. No.
Okay, so were you agnostic by the time you were teaching gospel doctrine?
Agnostic. Yeah, sure, probably. Yeah, I mean, like a closet agnostic, a hopeful agnostic.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever have any conflicts with the things you were supposed to be teaching? Being agnostic?
Wow, you're really pushing that agnostic label on me, aren't you? Are you? Well, here's what's funny about that, because I was reading Richard Dawkins, what is it, the God Dilemma? God Delusion, there you go. And he's got this scale of agnosticism, and I looked at it and I went, man, I'm a six. Same thing that he is on there, which I think mm-hmm. is functional atheist. But mm-hmm. but the thing that he didn't factor into it was what people wish that they were. He didn't say anything about what people wish that they were, and I wish that I was a three, which mm-hmm. which is, you know, something like still believing, but you know, not quite all the way there. And you know, so even though I was as a agnostic, I still wanted to have a belief in God, and so this desire to have, I guess that was my faith. It was, you know, I want there to be something out there, and I want Joseph Smith to be the person that Truman Madsen told me that he was, and these great tapes that I listened to as a missionary. You know, I want all this stuff to be what it was, and that was kind of what kept me through those times, even though I could see all of the man-made stuff there.